Hi, everyone. My name is Kirk Bachman, and welcome back to The Ultimate Dish. Today, I have the great honor of speaking with Ferdinand Metz, instrumental in establishing the Chef's Apprenticeship Certification, Master Chef Certification programs in the United States. Notably, he led the United States Culinary Olympic team to an unprecedented 3 consecutive world championships over a remarkable 20-year span. Metz's illustrious career includes a 4-year tenure as the president of the American Culinary Federation, where he left an indelible mark. He holds the distinction of being the first certified master chef in history, coupled with a rare achievement of earning a master's degree in business administration. During his 21-year tenure as president of the Culinary Institute of America, Ferdinand Metz witnessed the graduation of over 30,000 students. He's also been honored with nearly every major award in the culinary world, including the Lifetime Achievement Award and induction into the esteemed Who's Who in Cooking by the James Beard Foundation. Metz's contributions have been recognized internationally with distinctions such as the Medal of the French Republic and the esteemed Maître d'Honneur, titled by the Chef de Rôtisserie, where he stands as one of only 3 recipients in the United States. So join us today as we chat about the evolution of culinary apprenticeship, special skills chefs need to stand out today, and so much more. And there he is. Good morning. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Kirk. How are you?
I'm so good.
And
so just to set the stage for everybody, we haven't seen each other in a while, so it's really lovely to see you. And you're on the West Coast, and I assume, I hope that the weather is treating you well.
Good out here. Unfortunately, we had a lot of rain, which we, of course, need and love. And so things look good for the coming year.
Very nice. And tell us a little bit about what you see when you look out the window there. Are there some olive trees, some avocado trees?
And about 220 olive trees, avocados, peaches, dates, figs, you name it. It's all here. Herbs, of course, lots of herbs. I tell you honestly, for the first time really in my career, I'm cooking with a lot of things that are grown right outside.
Oh, isn't that something? That's wonderful.
Wonderful, indeed. It's a totally new experience, and I think it speaks to the heart of what cooking is all about.
Well said. You know, it reminds me, you know, we chatted briefly yesterday, and I went to my library. It was one of the last times we saw each other when I was still living in Chicago. You came to the house for dinner, and it was so sweet. I don't know if you remember this, but you brought this book for my children, and we still have it. And we made rouladen that day. We made rouladen with spätzle and cabbage, and I left the twine on the rouladen. I'll never live it down. I was telling my father about that. It's like, what are you thinking? So, there's so much to talk about. But I really, you know, first and foremost, congratulations. I think this is your 4th book, but this book, I'm not all the way through it yet. You can see that I've marked several pages. It's heavy. It's 400. From many, we are one. I mean, just a beautiful, appropriate title. I wanted to read one little quick piece here, which was just so reminiscent of what I went through in my life as well. Mm-hmm. Small hotel, bakery, you know, this expectation from father, right? But I love you said, this is page 77, you said, the idea of family and the manner with which we all worked together took much of the guesswork out of the many undefined issues, mm-hmm. the most important to me, who takes over the family business. So can we just jump on there, right, just quickly?
Sure.
We're going to talk a lot more about the accolades and such, but tell me about growing up in a family business with a brother who is also a master chef, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
I think it was very challenging, but on the other hand, it was supported by tradition. So when you have tradition, you don't question a lot of things because a lot of things are already set in place. You just understand this is tradition, that's the way it is. Having said that, my brother being 2 years older and sort of 2 years ahead of me in both the apprenticeships and all these kind of things, he did very well. And this, of course, follows our father's, I think we call it, suggested mandate to take an apprenticeship. And we understood what that meant, suggestive mandate, believe me. So we both started the apprenticeship in a cafe, the best cafe in Munich, where you learned, you know, all to make the cakes and the tarts and the chocolates and the whole thing. So that was a three-year experience. And then we went on to do a second apprenticeship in cooking at a newly opened hotel, which also is a big challenge to open a hotel up. So we became kind of rounded. And quite frankly, at the time, I didn't think it was a good idea to take yet another apprenticeship. But I joined the Culinary Institute. I could go into a bake shop or a kitchen and feel very comfortable talking about the curriculum, talking about how we're doing things, what we're doing things. And I think that was very important. Now, the only problem with my brother was that he was very good in what he was doing, and he finished as the best apprentice in the state of Bavaria.
Wow, yeah.
And so the expectations for me were to do the same, which fortunately I did, but I always was under a little bit more pressure to follow him. And he also did his master chef in Germany. And that kind of gave me the impetus to look at that program here in America. But there's one important thing about the apprenticeship, which took place in Munich, about a good hour train ride away from where my parents had their hotel, butcher shop, and restaurant. So every weekend we would come home. And, you know, there you sit, everybody's busy around you, and pretty soon you get involved, right? So every weekend, which was to the detriment of our social life, we made pastries and cakes. And here's the big thing. We were allowed to make mistakes.
Yeah,
huge. Sure. We didn't get punished for it, as opposed to the place in Munich, the apprenticeship.
Yeah.
You know, there was a little punishment involved if you made a mistake. And that gave us so much confidence and so much, we were so much ready than some of our colleagues in the apprenticeship. And it just brought it all together. So again, I kind of tried to follow that mantra into the curriculum of the CIA, hoping and allowing people to make mistakes, because that's where you learn the most.
It makes sense. So you mentioned that there was some encouragement, let's say, from your father. So when you and Reinhold started the apprenticeship in Munich with a specific goal in mind, I'm going to be pastry chef, I'm going to be cuisine chef, or what did your father encourage you to learn everything about the business?
It's everything, because they only have a butcher shop. So we grew up actually going with our grandfather out to the farmers to pick the calves and the pigs, take them to the slaughterhouse, and start processing those animals, make sausages and all kinds of specialties. And along the way, you kind of begin to understand there's no attachment to the animal. It can't be. It's always done with the recognition you are providing food for people. And
sure.
So we learned butchery just by the mere fact that we were in there in the butcher shop all the time.
And was there a point, just specifically for you, again, you're doing what your career path was supposed to be, but was there that moment where the inspiration actually came from you? Like, this is what I am meant to do.
Yeah, but it wasn't one singular moment. I think it was a progression and evolution, because when you do something, you become very good at it. Compared to contemporaries, that confidence tells you maybe that's what I should be pursuing for the rest of my life, and because it felt very comfortable.
And sure.
Of course, then later on, my brother had to take over the business, because he was 2 years older. That's just the way it was. I'm sure that's changed by now, but in those days, that's the way it went. And so I was free to go.
Talk about that a little bit. So you were free to go. So you're not even 20 years old, right, at this point, right? And Reinhold knows that he's going to come back and take over the business. And I mean, was it an option for you to stay? Or was it like, hey, there's only room for your brother and, you know, you have to make your own way?
Less than an option, it was an opportunity.
Oh, better, better word. Yeah.
Yeah, the opportunity to see other cuisines, visit other countries. And in those days, I actually got a phone call from a person I didn't know. And the individual said to me, "Do you want to come to America?" And I said, "Yeah, I'd love to. But who are you?" He identified himself as being the general manager of the biggest hotel in New York, the Astor Hotel, that served more banquets than any other place in America. And so I said, "Well, how come you're calling me?" He said, "Because I read in the paper this morning that you won the best apprenticeship in the state." And so I thought, maybe that's the right person. In those days, within 3 weeks, I had my visa and flew over to what was called Idlewild Airport, now Kennedy. And that they picked me up, and I started in the country club because his friend was the general manager of the country club in New Jersey, which by itself was an eye-opening experience. And that kind of brought me back to thinking about why is there not an apprenticeship? My first day, I walked into the kitchen, properly dressed, as we know, and they all laughed at me because they all had T-shirts and sloppy and unkempt and maybe not shaven. It was sort of the typical image of what the public had of a chef cook in those days. The T-shirt.
Rolled up. Yeah, yeah.
Up in a pack of Lucky Strike in there.
When I hear you say the word opportunity, it brings me back. My father, he came to Chicago versus New York, and a very similar story. And when I ask him, what he remembers the most about that journey, he says opportunity. He couldn't believe the opportunity. Everywhere you turn, there was so much work and so much to do.
Right.
Always busy. Similar for you in New York, Chef?
No, very definitely. So the country club was a unique experience in that I learned about what American food service was all about in many ways. But I also saw what tremendous opportunities you have to improve that. Mm-hmm. And improve we did. Reinhold came over for half a year, because he was already engaged, and there was a nice break before he had to take over the business. And a friend of mine from Chicago, also who did our apprenticeship together, came, and we kind of straightened out the kitchen. And it made a big difference. And so that was the club. And then, of course, the gentleman who brought me over, he said, "Whatever you do, doesn't matter, you have to work at Le Pavillon," which in those days was the best restaurant in America. And Pierre Fournier was the chef, who was then later on replaced by Clément Granger. Jacques Pepin was one of the cooks there. Mm. And I was the only non-French person in the place. And so my knowledge of French improved very rapidly, by necessity, I would say. And I really consider the 3 years I spent there as being pivotal to, it was like taking a new apprenticeship, pivotal to my career in terms of understanding quality, understanding that there's no compromise to be made when it comes to quality. And the kind of cooking was just amazing. So I actually spent more time there than people would normally do, because I came in at 10 o'clock in the morning, just to work with the fish cook and the entremetier and the rôtisseur, just to learn what they are doing. And then from 1 o'clock all the way down to 10 o'clock was my shift. And I was first in charge of the entremetier, making all the soups, the soufflés, the vegetables, all those kind of things. And it was a fantastic experience, so much so that I became then tourneur. Tourneur is the person that replaces, let's say, if one of the cooks or chefs is on vacation or not able to come in, then the tourneur has to be able to go to the different stations of the kitchen to help out and to fill in. Clément Granger was the chef who once was interviewed by Major Magazine in New York. In fact, I remember the editor, she spent more than a whole week at Le Pavillon to do that article. And later on, I read the article, and it was really funny because Clément Granger, being the chef, he also wanted to tell the rest of the crew that he could still cook, taking over the governorship position. In the tradition there was that, let's say, if an order of veal scallopini was placed, the person in the undermedia would repair the scallopinis and take them to the kitchen station where it's meant to be cooked. And I couldn't believe that they let the chef do that. So I jumped in, right? I helped him out. And
sure.
He said, well, to that editor, he said, well, you know, we have all French chefs in the kitchen, except for one fellow who is, that's Fernand. He called me Fernand, who is better than any of the other French chefs. To go to Le Pavillon from there, I wanted to see what hotel business was all about in New York, and went to the Plaza Hotel. Great society hotel, limited ballroom, limited facility. Why? So they wouldn't take the firemen's balls.
Sure.
People. So that was done by design. So they only catered to sort of the high society. I became banquet chef there, and sometimes I had over 20 functions in a day. You know, 500 people there, 200 there, 50 here, 25 there. And it was a tremendous experience to work in that kind of setting.
I was going to ask about the Plaza. I was there in January with the family, you know, to do the tea. And it felt very, the pageantry is still there. Mm. Most of the people that I spoke with had been there for 25, 30 years, right? And that's really important to keep that sort of standard at a certain level. And I don't know when the last time you were there, but do you believe, Chef, that is that limited to places just like the Plaza, or are there still some beautiful venues in the United States that still respect what it was like 50 years ago?
Well, almost in any city, you'll find an iconic hotel that dates back to
that
period. And, you know, the Palmer House comes to mind, and some of the other places, because they have lived on that tradition and perpetuated that tradition. I remember as banquet chef, I only had one other assistant to do all these things. So you were forced to be on good terms with the big crew in the kitchen.
Sure.
I need this one. I need that. And so a couple of bottles of beer went a long way to get things done.
Of course.
Then, of course, I made a really big jump to go to the H.J. Heinz Company in Pittsburgh as experimental chef. I had no clue what that meant, but I wanted to experience corporate America. And corporate America it was. I mean, in many ways, totally different. But I understood that in food research and development, and later on I managed the department as a cook, now, which is an interesting thing. I had PhDs working for me, scientists. Why? Because Heinz believed that at the very end, it's about flavor, not necessarily about chemistry, although they were both there. So I actually started out as a chemistry major in my undergraduate, and then finally realized, then I become an expert in two things, namely cooking and chemistry. And I said, that's not a good idea. And I switched to business and finally got also my MBA at the university up in Pittsburgh. So that was a very interesting and huge change for me to go from Le Pavillon to and Plaza to go to a food manufacturer. But I've learned a lot how you go about developing recipes, but also how you go about cooking in quantities, which is totally different than what we are usually in. You know, if you have to make a cream sauce for, let's say, 700 gallons, huge. It's a different way of doing it.
And the flavor has to be there. You know, I was just going to insert one comment about Pittsburgh. In my experience there, the cooks and the chefs of that city have such a profound respect for the craft of cooking. When it comes to the ACF, more chefs than not were members, active members in the ACF. I remember Heinz Slauer and I did a demo for you at a ACF conference there. I think we did Sauerbraten or something. It was a German dish. But you could always count on Pittsburgh to pack the house. And highest level of certifications. Was it like that when you started in Pittsburgh as well?
Well, I think what coalesced the organization was when we started to think about certification in apprenticeship. Because, you know, like any organization, you need a purpose, you need a goal, you need something to keep the membership excited and involved. And there was nothing better than that. Apprenticeship, we decided to do a hybrid model. A hybrid in the sense that understanding that in America you should have a degree of some great practical experience. We partnered with the local community college, has some great cooperations there. And what we did first, we developed the program, implemented it locally in Pittsburgh and surrounding areas, and only after a few years did we take it publicly on ACF-wide. And the same for certification. Now, certification was a different challenge because up till now, anybody could put a toque on and say, I'm a chef. That's the way it was, period.
Mm-hmm.
And for the first time, now you ask for qualifications, which is tough.
Sure.
And there are chefs in the Duquesne Club, which one of the outstanding private clubs in America. And there are many clubs in Pittsburgh, because at one time it was the home of more corporate headquarters than any other city in America. Alcoa, Westinghouse, U.S. Steel, you know, all those kind of places. So there were a lot of clubs and great clubs that people could, you know, be really challenged in their cooking. So in certification, having to now for the first time ever demand some qualification was a tough road. And we bridged that by the leadership of the Pittsburgh chefs that would take the certification themselves. And those two programs coalesced the organization to a degree where they really felt proud of, where they felt involved, and where they also were the beneficiary. Because all of a sudden, you know, if you could say, I'm a certified executive chef or whatever, you became more noticed, you became more acclaimed, and oftentimes your salary was commensurate to that status.
Sure, yeah. I wanted to jump on that real quick. We talked about your role in establishing the Chef's Apprenticeship Certification, and then also the Master Chef Certification. So we're all the way back to the 70s. And just to provide some added context, the ACF Certified Master Chef is the only American Master Chef certification in the U.S. recognized by the Department of Labor, and it's my understanding is that it's designed to identify chefs who, to your point, chef, have demonstrated mastery of culinary competency and expertise through education, experience, knowledge, skills. I'm curious how that got started and how that has advanced over the years. It's probably a whole nother podcast, but just at a high level, you went from identifying or recognizing industry professionals with certifications, and then it moved to this high level, which was very similar to what you were used to in Europe, right?
Yeah, basically, again, a hybrid model combining American ideas and criteria and European methods. And I was sort of, when I started the program, because my brother had a MasterChef degree from Germany, and I was thinking maybe I need to go over there and to take that examination, which unfortunately would take 6 weeks to be away from your job. In America, that wouldn't fly, period.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
What we did was we developed the program based on the European model, and was fortunate because my father and brother, both master chefs, I could understand how they're doing it, what the methods and the procedures were. And so we created that hybrid model, and with the idea that it's really, when you graduate from that, you're really a complete professional. And I think the result of which was also commensurate with that goal. And as a result, the program has grown, but not to the degree that we had hoped.
Okay.
And at one time it was a 10-day program. Every day. You come in the morning, like 7 o'clock till 10 o'clock, there was a theoretical subject. whether it be purchasing or food to sanitation or whatever. And then from about 11 till 7 in the evening, you were assigned a cooking task. And it could have been anything. You threw a number out of a hat, and it told you what the assignment was. And that requires really individuals to think very fast. So the moment you get that assignment, you have to jump on it because of the timing, etc. And so the program changed. I think now it's 6 days, allowing people to brush up on especially the theory subjects, the theoretical ones, and complete them. So by the time they go into the practical, they only have to focus on that. There are debates whether that's good or bad, but it is what it is. So, yeah, the program has not, and through AMCO, we are trying to make them more accessible without, which is really a key, without compromising the standards.
I was told once that when you arrive for the 10 days, the original 10 days of the certified Master Chef exam, you're not there to learn. You're there to demonstrate your cooking ability and your knowledge. And how important is, this is kind of a, you know, just a general question, very theoretical. How important is it in your mind, Chef, for chefs who respect the craft to put themselves, I know how my father received the, you know, the German Master Chef as well. And when he talked about it, I mean, there was never a doubt in his mind. That's what he was going to do. To challenge himself to the highest level and then come to America.
Yep.
Is that missing today with chefs?
Well, it's different now. Chefs understand that title would allow them to not only prove to themselves, but to their crew and to their management staff that they have, you know, put themselves in a position where they really can understand and be a complete cook in many ways. So that part has not changed. But I think there is a general feeling that all, you can study for the program. I don't think so.
Yeah, that goes back to my original understanding, right?
You have to put in place what you know. And it's all about your passion of cooking, your understanding that less is more. And by the way, that phrase, less is more, is repeated in my book about 50 times. I thoroughly believe in it. I think it's just such an important thing to understand when not to interfere with nature. Take a wonderful New Jersey beefsteak tomato, right? At its best, ripest, bursting with flavor. As a cook, you shouldn't do anything to it. Maybe sprinkle a little olive oil and salt, and that's it.
Leave it alone, yeah.
Because you can't improve it. But this requires an understanding and confidence on behalf of the cook to do that. Because many cooks say, oh, then I cannot show my expertise. I cannot show, okay, so you show your creativity, you show your expertise, and you screw it all up. You change what nature has provided. And I think it takes a seasoned and experienced and confident cook to get to that point.
Very well said. Perfect segue into talking a little bit about culinary competitions. You've been involved with competition for a very long time, namely the U.S. Olympic team. Could you talk a little bit about your experience? Particularly, a lot of people that hear about the Culinary Olympics don't even realize that there is a Culinary Olympics every 4 years. But yeah. I'd love for you to speak a little bit about what it's like and what it takes to compete on a global stage. And even competing before the Culinary Olympics, there's competitions across the country all the time, right? How important is that for us?
I think it's, as long as you think it's a learning experience, it's very important. If you think about medals, forget it. Mm-hmm. Then you become what I call a competition cook. And a competition cook cooks only for the appearance and, you know, making one plate. They never think about, oh, but maybe I have to make 100 plates like that. And I couldn't do it the way I do it for a competition. So you have to get rid of that mindset, and you have to understand that it only works if you can do it in a larger setting and get away from the idea that you cook for competition. You cook for a customer, no matter what. Even if the food is not going to be consumed, but it has to look like that, it has to feel like that, it has to have the aroma, it has to have everything that you would do in a restaurant. So in the Olympics, and in my book, I have a section that says, that talks about how to develop your own food philosophy. And I think that's crucial because the food philosophy is something that gives you guidance, that gives you something to lean on. And when I came to the CIA, I had developed a fair amount of that philosophy, realizing that's an ongoing, changing element. It's never going to be static. It always will change because you have different experiences. But the challenge there was, how do I intertwine my personal food philosophy with that, the existing one at the CIA? The challenge. And the only way we could overcome that is to basically listen to a lot of people and understanding, and out of that formed an institutional philosophy on cooking. I'll give you an example. Just to talk about bechamel in our books, we spend a whole day arguing, debating, discussing how to make bechamel sauce because we had instructions from 20 different countries around the world, different ideas, different method, different this. But out of that came a fundamental recognition that 80% of what we do needs to be consistent for a student so they're not confused. 20% can be the individual input of the instructor, of their experience in the past and whatever they felt was going to enhance that process. And so, again, the same philosophy carried on with the teams that I was involved with over 20 years with culinary teams. And, in 1976, which was such an incredible year for American food and wine, at the 76 tasting in Paris, wines from Chateau Montelena, the Chardonnay, and the Cabernet Sauvignon won over the French best Grand Cru varietals.
Unheard of, yeah.
The French writer Odette Kahn, who was the head of the French wine board, she demanded to have her worksheet back because she could believe what the scores were. In 76, the same time we entered the Culinary Olympics, we were basically a nobody. I was on the team in 68. We did okay. And then in 68, we started to understand what it is that we needed to do. Mm-hmm. And so here we were. Also, as part of that experience, we were invited by the State Department to cook a luncheon for the Queen of England in Boston during the bicentennial. And that was by itself a unique experience because we were told that after the luncheon, the team should line up. And if the queen wants to say hello, she will do such that. So here they were. They came out of the dining room and the queen made a beeline towards us. And the mayor of Boston, Kevin White at the time, put his hand on her shoulder. Which you're just on food. The CIA and the British Secret Service were all over the place.
At top, yeah. Oh, my gosh.
She shunned them away. She took charge. And she gave him an ice-cold look that could have killed, I think. And in spite of that, went straight to us.
She wanted to talk to you. Yeah, right. Yeah.
So that was a unique experience. But going back to the Olympics in 76... we had a team philosophy, and we carried that through, and we decided to cook dishes that people could replicate in restaurants throughout America. So at the awards presentation, the announcer said, and for the first time they had first, second, and third podiums like they have in the Olympics, right? Sports Olympics. And so they said, well, we like the American team that came in third. And we liked the American team to come to the podium, which for us was unbelievable, right?
Wow, yeah, Ever. Yeah.
And then he said, oh, excuse me, we made a mistake. American team tied the French team for third, which I thought was wonderful.
Yeah.
Better than being up there on your own, right?
And oh, my God. Monumental. Yeah. Yeah.
The problem was the podium was designed for six chefs. There was a lot of this going on, a lot of elbows to maintain your spot up there. But that was a monumental experience for us. And really, that's why I say 70s, the decades of the 70s were so instrumental. Apprenticeship came about. Certification came about. MasterChef was started. The Olympics, the Paris tasting, all these things brought a tremendous amount of excitement and confidence, saying that America can compete and can be right up there with anybody else.
And you had so much to do with that. And it brings me to some personal feelings. I'm so amazed by all of the awards and the accolades over the years and the milestones that you're personally responsible for, Chef. And I think about myself, growing up in a baker's family and a hotel family, and I've been involved with culinary education for 30 years now, and I have a lot to thank you for, because in addition to all those things that you were working on, you had the foresight to bring a level of degree to the CIA back before anyone was thinking about that. Go to culinary school and actually earn an associate's degree with transferable credit by a regional accreditor, and then a bachelor's degree, and so on and so forth. So first and foremost, I wanted to thank you for that, but also to take advantage of this time together and have you kind of talk about what was going on in your mind that you were thinking, we need to elevate the educational levels of those who are studying our craft. Brilliant, really.
Again, it was viewed as an opportunity to do that. And when you're the head of an organization, you have a lot of influence.
Yes, you do. Yes, you do.
Right? So as a result, we focused a lot on the culinary aspects, not to neglect the others, but the culinary is what we were all about. And so when we hired an instructor, before that person was hired, they had to cook a 3-course meal for the other department heads, and within a time frame from a mystery basket, because that tells you more than any resume or anything else that you need to know. And the real question that always arose, and I staunchly defended that, when people said, well, you cannot make a good chef into an instructor. And I said, wait a minute, what do you rather do? Take a mediocre chef and make a good chef of that person, or take a experienced chef and make a instructor? I always follow the latter. And as a result, I hired my former boss at the Plaza, Chef Andre Rene, as an instructor. I was happy to hire chefs in their 50s and 60s, kind of a little bit burned out by the demands of the industry, would give me another 10 years of incredible experience, something which you just cannot pay for.
And stories that you cannot.
That became a really standout point because, not only were they very seasoned, but they also, for the first time in their life, had a life.
Yeah. They were home at night. Yeah.
Both weekends and holidays and what have you. But they also begin to realize they can form their own legacy, by which as much as anybody, when you're in teaching, it's not your salary, it's not your reputation, it's your legacy of having had an impact on so many lives of different students, which you just cannot replicate anywhere else.
So well said. And to that point, I wanted to read a quote. This is from Stephen Michaelides, former editor-in-chief, associate publisher at Restaurant Hospitality Magazine. He says, and I quote, "Aside from Ferdinand Metz, there is no other person in America who has witnessed, supported, and actively influenced the evolution of American cuisine while stewarding for 21 years the fortunes of the Culinary Institute of America, the country's most influential culinary college. I wanted to ask, what a wonderful time, and, you know, 30,000 plus students that came across that podium. I know how it makes me feel. I'd love to hear how that makes you feel.
You know, in 21 years, there was not one time when I walked into the, and I usually must have fairly early, 7 o'clock, I walked in, the classes already were in session, the morning classes. I always felt a sense of excitement, a sense of presence, a sense of passion for the school when I walked in. And I think the same carried forward when you start to think about the curriculum that you want to institute and the standards that you're trying to set. But it always felt like a very special place. And it goes right back to this comment of yours about the legacy of seeing that many students come across the stage to successfully accept their diploma and go on to the world. And quite frankly, they made a huge difference. Culinary schools really, as a whole, contributed so much to the quality of food in America today, which you only understand if you understand what happened in the past, which was not the very best. But, you know, that part, really, graduations, although I attended over 250 graduations, it never became, oh my God, another one. Oh, it always felt special.
Yeah.
Always special.
Yeah.
Because you look in the eyes of those people that graduate, hopeful, excited, passionate, you knew that many of them would really fulfill their dream of becoming a good chef or a restaurant owner or somehow successful in the industry.
Yeah, so well said. So well said, Chef.
By the way, Steve, I just visited. We have a little place down in Mexico, Puerto Vallarta, and Steve has moved down there.
Oh, really?
I visited him. I gave him a copy of the book.
Oh, beautiful, beautiful. Well, let's talk about the book. I've got it right here. You released your latest book, I think your fourth book, From Many We Are One, which reveals the never-before-told story, right? And rebirth, like we've been talking about today, and globalization of American cuisine, influenced by iconic restaurants, shaped by passionate individuals like yourself, and enriched by education. There was, as I was preparing to chat with you, I read an Amazon reviewer, and that person said, and I quote, "I was fortunate to see Chef Metz cook several times, and his meticulous pursuit of quality is truly inspiring. The book perfectly exemplifies his solid work. In my interactions with him, he always was a wonderful mentor, inspiring us and his actions and his advice." I want to ask about what inspired you to write the book and what readers can expect. But I do want to set it up. His quote is so perfect, right? When I think about Ferdinand Metz, you and I were standing, this is years ago, you and I were standing around a group of students. You may not even remember it because it was so casual and so informal. They were all just kind of asking some questions. And you said, "If I gave you sugar and eggs and milk, what would you make?" And it was so simple, yet the students, you know, they thought it was a trick or something, right? And then you talked about ice cream and then the smiles and, you know, the simplicity with which you have been able to deliver education and inspiring through your actions. I'd love for you to talk about what inspired these 400 pages. And I've got notes all over the place. I'm not through it yet, but, you know, congratulations, first of all. Just
Thank
wonderful.
You.
Yeah.
First of all, the title really explains that American cooking wasn't born in the absence of any other influence. I mean, it's the influence of every ethnic group that ever came to our shores and started to cook their homegrown meals and share them with Americans. And just read the title. No, the book kind of evolved. It became bigger by the minute, so to speak, because, you know, excited about doing something, you say, "Well, I want to write about this, I want to write about that." And quite frankly, I had to admit to myself that the book is basically a broad overview. Let's say if a student needs to know what the history of American cooking is all about, but not having to read 10 books to do that, this will do it, because it kind of encapsulates important events, important stages on this, during the evolution, and to show how all that happened and what it means for us today. So almost every chapter of this book could have its own book written.
Sure.
But again, I wanted to cover a whole base of different things. And so the book became bigger by the minute, more or less. You know, I wanted to add a debate about new techniques. What does molecular cooking mean to us? Nouvelle cuisine, fusion cuisine. And I blended that with some of the historical elements of cuisine and today's application. I also wanted to raise some social concerns, you know, like what happened to the women in our industry? Why was the media so inconspicuously absent in recognizing the value of women chefs in America? I mean, it's amazing. Usually the media, they want to jump on every new story they can. They didn't do that. Why? And I talked to a lot of women chefs and a lot of our women chef graduates from the school, and, you know, that came to the foreground. So I wanted to cover that. And I essentially finished up by saying, you know what happened to the American women's soccer and hockey teams? They rose from obscurity to world powers. Now, why? Because Title IX. Title IX demanded that every college would provide equal number of spaces for female athletes as for male athletes, scholarships, opportunities. And then I said, maybe it's time that our food service industry invokes our own Title IX in order to highlight the contribution of women. And the same social concern was covered by talking about African-American chefs. You know, their contributions to cuisine and their legacy. And I think it was just an important thing to highlight, not to glance over, but to really devote some, you know, several pages to those issues and let people know that these are issues that we are concerned with and we should really understand them. But there is some good news, because as you know, at culinary schools, a major proportion is now female students.
Sure.
And they have learned, and the male students have learned to work together with them. So I am very hopeful that in the future, this whole issue of male-female and male dominance and all this kind of stuff will disappear, because they have already worked alongside each other. The same thing I'm hoping to see happen with African-American chefs. Now, we have seen most recently a great influx of new chefs, black chefs that have made the headlines and have done some great things. And so it's important for our industry, just as simple as that, to recognize that and to promote that.
Along those lines, Chef, what's next for cooking in America? What do the next 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years look like in your mind?
I think that we have settled in and understand that it's not just only about great cooking as it was developed during the 70s, 80s, and 90s, but now it's to take that and to make a business of it, a good and to be customer focused. And for that reason, I devoted a whole section in the book on hospitality and on all kinds of issues that today have an array, because people have not paid attention to those. I have a comical section in the book that talks about the experience of going to a restaurant today where the two people at the front desk talk about their weekend plans, and you should stand there and hope to get a word in, you know, to get seated.
Exactly.
Then you get to the table and somebody throws you the menu like a frisbee, And Joe will take care of you. Ma, no kidding, Joe will. Joe comes around and, you know, does his thing and gives you the litany and of the new dishes and the origin where the chicken came from, which all is not important. And then Joe comes around and he has at a table for two, as an example, he has the dishes, right? And he comes and stops at your table and waits. And what he's waiting for is that you, the customer, cleared the paraphernalia from the table.
Make room for the plate, yeah.
And oh, my gosh. A table for two, he asks, who gets the fish? The table for two. So, yeah, the book talks about some of those issues, too, because I think they are important. And I think this part of what the settling in period is that we have started now, and I think that will carry on to the future, namely to take all the good things that we learned and combine them with hospitality. And speaking of hospitality, there's another certification issue, which asks, why don't we have professional waiters? They have no organization like ACF to lean on. They have no educational opportunities, basically. Sure, in your school and ours, they worked in the dining room and have more of an idea what to do than most other waiters.
Mm-hmm.
They are very friendly, which is great, and they don't have to be classically trained, but they have to understand hospitality. And the reason why they have not progressed to a professional status is because there's no certification and no organization to back them up and to promote them and to advocate for their goals. I think in this settling in period, blending our skills with a great sense of hospitality and business acumen is going to be the successful formula.
Absolutely great advice. I was going to ask, you know, what's next for culinarians today in front of the house, back of the house. I can't believe that we've gotten to the end of our hour. I do have another question or two for you, if you can stay with me. But before I get to our last question, what's next for Ferdinand Metz? Is there another book in the works?
I'm kind of thinking about doing another book of vegan dishes.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah.
Why I do that? My wife and I, we were challenged by our daughter who is vegan, to say she challenged us to be on a vegan diet for a whole week. We did that more than that. We did it for almost 3/4 of a year. And I learned a lot about that. I learned an awful lot about how to develop flavors without the meat protein, without the drippings of the meat roast that usually results in that great flavor. I learned that you needed to really understand cooking a little bit more, because now you have to understand where do I get the flavors from? You know, is it the lemon zest? Is it a certain spice? And I think in that process, cooking techniques become so much more important. Now, back in the 60s, if you wanted a vegetable plate, if you were one of the real rare people who wanted to a vegetarian plate, chefs would simply take, well, okay, we have a broiled tomato that was with the meat dish. Okay. Put a broiled tomato, or we have some string beans out of the, that's another thing, out of the steam table. You put that on. You know, we have a little broccoli, and that was it. Today, you...
Out it went, yeah.
a vegetarian plate. And so I was very intrigued, because I think it challenged me to understand more about what cooking can be and should be all about, because now you have to look for flavor developments through essences, through reductions, through special seasonings that we, in the presence of meats, not always have to do, because meat carries center plate of the dish carries the dish in many ways.
I'm so happy to hear that. My family does much on the plant-based diet. Did you feel better a little bit, noticeably?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
We are discretionary vegans. Vegan. Because I never want to, you know, say, oh, I cannot have a piece of meat if I want to. Yes, I can.
Sure, yeah.
Chicken or whatever. Well, we are very discretionary in how we select our menus. and we don't deny ourselves anything. Why should we? But I always have to say that we are paying so much more attention to not only cooking, but buying the right kind of ingredients. I mean, cooks need to understand that you're not going to make a great dish with ingredients that are inferior. You're just not going to do it.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Why don't you do yourself a favor and pay more attention to the purchasing, to buying the best quality? You know, when it comes to delivery of ingredients, as an example, the word will get around which chef really has somebody there to control, to reject certain items because they were not up to standards. That goes around. And the chef who doesn't gets whatever's left.
That goes around too. That's a perfect segue into, Chef, the name of our little chat is The Ultimate Dish. So given what we just talked about, in your mind, what is the ultimate dish?
Well, that's an easy question to answer because we just did that the other day. We had some friends over, 7 people or 9 people, whatever. And I made the dish that I like probably the most, and that's braised oxtails.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just the flavor that you can develop with in the sauce itself, the tenderness of the meat, interspersed with a little bit of fat, so it's very tender, very juicy. Sure, it takes a long time to cook. It takes understanding how you do that.
Yeah.
But the dish itself is just incredible.
Paired with what wine?
You know, in our case, last time we had a combination of sweet and regular mashed potatoes combined, you know.
Yeah.
Brussels sprouts, but not charred. Very simple, but, you know, the flavors just are incredible.
Perfect ultimate dish. And a beautiful Cabernet to go along with it?
Beer.
Beer, okay.
Yeah.
Perfect.
In that case, we had some beer. Now, let me make a quick more comment. When you look at the book, what's very strange is since there are no testimonials in here on the back page, right? For some reason, that didn't get in there, and I don't want to get into that. But we had over 20 testimonials, and they will be featured in the new book. Reprinted book from, you know, Thomas Keller, Jasper White, from Sarah Moulton, from Drew Nipuran, the restaurant owners, chefs, you know. And it just was incredible that they didn't make the first edition of the book. But that will be corrected, and hopefully that will work out much better.
And I will await my copy of the updated. I appreciate that.
Hopefully it'll get done real soon. So things are good. If anybody wants some advice about writing a book, be prepared. You know, and it's not a cookbook. It's a book about cooking, but not a cookbook.
Yeah, absolutely.
But be prepared that for the fact that writing is easy, getting it done from that point on is the hard part.
It's another story. Yeah.
Totally other story. Because you're venturing into areas that are not familiar to you, publishing.
Yeah. Sure.
Et cetera, et cetera. So.
How long did the process take from beginning to end?
Writing about 2 years.
Okay.
And of course, then the pandemic came in between. All the publishing houses in New York were shut down for that time period, which was not all bad because, contrary to some advice I got, which says, once you write it, don't go back to it. I did go back.
You went back, yeah, yeah.
Because you have another idea, and you say, well, I need to clarify this point, or I want to add another segment to it, like that, how to develop your own food philosophy and the hospitality aspect, as well as some interesting stories about the chefs that we interact throughout our careers. And so that you really, I think it made the book better, but it took longer time. Yeah.
Well, this has been such a pleasure and an honor for me to spend some time with you. Congratulations on all the success, Chef. And let's stay in touch.
Sounds good. Thank you for having me. And yeah, are you going to be at the convention?
Yeah, this year. And that reminds me, too, when you press that first harvest of olives, I want to know all about it.
Yeah, we are hopeful. We are hopeful. They have some olives for oil and others for, you know, be salted.
Sure. Yeah.
So it's good. We'll learn a lot. Like, it, you know, learning is a process that doesn't end. And I think that holds true for any kind of certification, master chef. I always tell people, that's not the end, for God's sake. This is a beginning. Maybe
you're just getting started.
More of a tool to learn more. So.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the Ultimate Dish Podcast, brought to you by Auguste Escoffier School of Culinary Arts. Visit escoffier.edu/podcast to find any materials mentioned during the podcast, including notes, links, and other resources. And if you can, please leave us a rating on Apple or Spotify and subscribe to support our show. This helps us reach more aspiring individuals ready to take the next step toward their dream careers. Thanks for listening.